Hello, and welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the country and the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly and social manner. The following disclaimer applies for tonight's episode. The thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely those of the participants and do not reflect any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Please remember to keep your comments in the YouTube chat and Facebook chat and here in the show on the level and open to the public. Tonight, as usual, we have a great show, and we would love to bring you into that show as well. So please share your feedback with us, with your questions, your comments, your witty banter in the YouTube chat running alongside this video or on the Facebook live stream. So we are excited to get together with you all tonight. It is almost Halloween. My name's Jason Richards. I'm a past master of Vacation Lodge number 16 in Clifton, Virginia, and we'll go over to Joe Martinez.
Hello! This is Joe Martinez. I am an avid skull collector, as you can see, and tonight we're actually not going to talk about skulls, but I am the senior warden of Manassas Lodge number 182 in Manassas, Virginia, and a member of about 19,000 other things, and super stoked to be here tonight.
Awesome. Happy to have you with us, Joe. And last but not least, we got a skeleton crew tonight for Halloween. Spooky. Robert Johnson.
Hey, y'all. The second guy on the show tonight wearing a hat. Jason's the only one cool enough with hair to show off. So past master Waukegan Lodge, number 78 in Waukegan, Illinois, and a current sitting secretary at Space Novum, 1183 in Libertyville, Illinois. Good old Main Street town, USA.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Robert. I really appreciate it.
You guys make me feel so included wearing hats because, as Robert said, I don't have a lot going on up here. So I appreciate that.
It's okay. I'm wearing my hat in solidarity tonight. But anyway, as we get started in tonight's show, want to take a quick moment to thank our Patreons for being supporters. You all are absolutely amazing, and we're so excited that that you're along for the journey with us. So if you subscribe to our Patreon, go to patreon.com, look up the Masonic Roundtable. If you're at a Knight or Squire level, we'll give you access to our very own Knights and Squires Facebook group. That place is always hopping. All of us are in there. The TMR alumni are in there as well. And so we do everything from, you know, post about symbolism and answer questions to, you know, helping people figure out, you know, research project ideas and things like that. So it's a community, and it's an awesome thing to be a part of. And it's a great way to keep in touch with all of us. So we appreciate you, and we appreciate what we do. What's up, Joe?
So two things. Most importantly, it appears that tonight is being sponsored by Masonic Revival, which they're not sponsoring us, but we seem to sponsor him a lot. So kudos to them. Second, I just saw something on YouTube, which I have to give a huge shout out for. There is someone watching from Mount Horeb number 114 from the Most Worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Georgia. And I heard that there is now... We don't do Masonic news anymore, but we have to say something about this. The Grand Lodge of Georgia and the Most Worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Georgia now, I guess it's recognize one another or are in amity with one another. But kudos there. I guess there's only, what, four or five more states that are holding out on that five states left that five. Don't have that mutual recognition. So kudos, Georgia. Much love from us. And much love to you, brother.
Yes, makes us super happy. We were stoked to hear that news over the past week. So congratulations to both Grand Lodges in Georgia. We are so, so happy that you all have taken this awesome step. Let's knock that list down to zero for the U.S. I think that'd be awesome. Cool. Well, it is, as we're recording this, it is the 28th of October. We're just 3 days shy of Halloween. And so on Halloween, we like to do spooky shows, whether it be Harry Houdini or Memento Mori or death episodes. And so what non-Masons might not be aware of is that there are there's actually an entire class of Masonic symbols related to death. And death features very prominently in the Masonic system because it largely reinforces, you know, what we're here to do, which is, you know, do the best we can with that we have on this earth. So Joe and Robert, you know, why else would we have so many symbols all denoting the same thing?
Sure. So I mean, for me, I think the symbols of mortality, right? That's the less scary way to say symbols of death, right? Because they truly are symbols of mortality. And I think for a lot of us, Freemasonry really is a lesson in mortality. It's learning to live that well-lived life in the time that we have it. So especially when you get to the Master Mason's degree, and we won't go into details, obviously, you really learn about the concept of your own mortality, what it means to be present on this earth and then not be present anymore. And then what do you do with that time that you have here? How do you spend it? So I think that some of these symbols, you know, the skull or the memento mori is probably one of the most striking, and it's one of the most obvious, but there are other symbols of mortality that we're going to talk about tonight that impart those same lessons. So I think it's a really big topic that we cover, maybe a little bit loosely, in our degrees, but it should really be covered in our education and our symbolism later down the road.
Agreed. And one thing I would note is there seems to be, at least in a lot of Freemasonry today, there seems to be a lot of hesitation toward embracing the symbolism associated with mortality. You know, Robert, you wrote a paper on the Midnight Freemasons several years ago on, you know, whether or not skulls were Masonic, kind of, you know, an argument for them being, you know, part of the craft.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at it, historically speaking, it's not something that you can even debate. I mean, the skull is an emblem of mortality and has been a part of Freemasonry since the beginning. Regardless of what anybody wants to say. I mean, we have historical evidence to show that the skull was used before the coffin even, but, you know, we since have moved to a more eloquent symbol, perhaps, as something like the coffin, which is something we'll talk about this evening. But, yeah, I think the whole idea, in fact, I would even go so far as to say it would be my educated guess and my general feeling that if there was a concrete piece of dogma within Freemasonry, it is absolutely something to do with this idea of the immortality or the impermanence of death, or I don't even like the word death. The Master's Word, I'm sorry, not the Master's Word, but the book called The Master's Lectures, has an entire lecture about this and says the most egregious thing about, you know, living is the fact that we use this term death, and it's erroneous. It is a change, right? And so maybe this is why it's such a stark thing that we focus on with these intense symbols that we'll discuss tonight, is remember the lesson about this, you know, like, We don't necessarily know what comes next, but as Joe maybe pointed out here, do what you can while you're here.
Well, I think just to touch on that, and I know we said we wouldn't talk about skulls tonight because we covered that, let's go back to Memento Mori, right? Remember that you will die. I think we gloss over that as an institution, right? But for those that have gone through the process, whether it was a really well done process or not, you were put through a death play, a dramatic drama about death and either raising or rebirth, right? Whichever route you choose to go down. Like I said, some people, they get a really vanilla experience, and it's, you know, something akin to a college fraternity, which I was a member of, so I'm not going to poo-poo on them too hard. But I think our Masonic initiation has a very specific goal in mind. It's to teach you that at some point in life, you are going to die. You're not going to be here anymore. And what is it that you've done for this world, and what do you leave behind? Not physical stuff, but what do you leave behind for those that are left, you know, after you've gone? Some lodges I've seen do an amazing job of imparting that lesson. You know, it's striking, and it should be striking. I think just in general, we as a society have this really big fear about death, right? We're taught to fear death. So I don't know if maybe Masonic ritual has been so striking in its delivery is to shock that out of your system and say, no, you're going to die sometime. You know, everybody dies, death and taxes, right? Those are the only two certainties in life. But we gloss over that, especially when we're kids. You know, my kids don't worry about dying. You know, they live life as if they're carefree. They jump off banisters and, you know, fly off trampolines and stuff like that. But as we get to our age, we start to become afraid of everything, right? And it holds us back from our true potential, I think. So without getting off on a really long tangent, we could have another show about that in and of itself. No more skulls from Joe tonight.
Well, I do think, oh, go ahead, Robert.
I was just going to say, you hit on it, right? It's the potential thing. You can read in various historical texts that talk about things like the mysteries at Eleusis or Dionysus or whatever. And while we have some clues to some of those rituals that revolve around the idea of life, birth, rebirth, seasons, and farming even, or whatever the case might be, that the point was to convey something along this line, right? That in fact, when we have, you know, going back to actually what I was going to say about Eleusis and things, we don't have any actual evidence to say what those were, but we have context clues from people who went through those degrees that didn't really say what happened, but talked around it. And one thing that always stuck out to me was Alexander the Great's commentary, which, again, I'll paraphrase like I always do because I can't remember it. But he basically said, anybody who's anybody has taken the mysteries. And then it goes on to say that anybody who's gone through this death rite or whatever you want to call it has been changed irreversibly for the rest of their life. They're now industrious, pious individuals who fear nothing and just go out and do it. Like, you know, Nike of the, 500 BCE.
Well, it's because they've already faced death once, so they don't have to be afraid of it again. I think the real fear with death has been the fear of the unknown and just not knowing what it's like to cross that last, you know, liminal barrier into your last initiatory rite of this life. So with that in mind, oh, go ahead, Robert. With that in mind, we should probably get into some symbolism. Wrong button.
Or not.
There we go. I get it one of these days. So what happens when John leaves me in charge with like an hour's notice? All right. Lesser known symbols of mortality. First, we've got the scythe, and this is often paired together with Father Time and the Weeping Virgin. But we'll start with the scythe. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll talk about that symbol from, I believe it was Jeremy Cross, right, who first drew or engraved that symbol in the 1800s. But let's focus on the individual scythe right now. But it really is an image, especially when you see it during Masonic lectures, that reminds us that death is coming to reap the souls of the sinners and the saints alike, right? It's irrespective of your station in society. In that symbol of the Weeping Virgin and Father Time, it's there to show that that is a death symbol, that death comes for us all, and that the scythe, again, it reaps everybody alike. You know, so it doesn't matter if you are a president or a pauper, death comes for you. And again, I think it goes back to that fear of death that we have as a society. But I don't want to turn this into a sociological discussion, but you know, it's really a stark reminder that, and how often does your everyday person sit there and think about, ooh, I'm going to die at some point. You know, I don't think that happens that often. But that scythe is that reminder. And Robert mentioned Eleusis before, which was absolutely a life, death, and rebirth play. We don't know the details, as he said, but the scythe features prominently in agricultural examples of the seasons, the death, the growth, the reaping, and then the harvest. So, yeah, one of many.
The scythe, though, is really interesting. If you take it a step further beyond this idea of just cutting down, in ritual, there's this line that says something along the lines of falling down to once again enrich our Mother Earth. It really does allude to this idea of the cutting down of man as a necessary tool in the preservation of the human species and the preservation of the planet on which we live, right? I mean, this is the cutting down and the return of the mineral of man to back to whence he came. So, reminder.
Yeah, no, that's very well. That's getting super biblical there, right? Because we gloss over that in Genesis 2 when we talk about, you know, from dust you came and dust you shall return, right? Man, according to the Bible, came from the earth, and at some point in time, he's going to go back in there. We show that nowadays by burying people in the ground, right? And at some point, you know, if they don't have a fancy coffin, at some point they're going to decompose and return to the earth. So whether you're a sheaf of wheat or a rich dude, your purpose is to be reincorporated. We hit all three, Jason, those rites of passage, that reintegration.
Yeah.
So the scythe is the arbiter of that, right? It's the one that causes that to happen. So super, super cool symbol.
Yeah, absolutely awesome. And moving on to Father Time. Who's this old guy?
So he's a dude. He's not a Pisces. He's got a bad attitude. So sorry, all. We got about an hour's notice to fill in some of the gaps here. So I sound a little bit like an idiot. So I'm going to be as intelligent as possible. But Father Time is, again, this is another symbol that ultimately comes to us from someone named Jeremy Cross in the 1800s when it's used Masonically. But Father Time is depicted in the sculpture of the Weeping Virgin, and he's counting the ringlets of her hair, basically showing the passage of time, right? So usually, and I think the other symbols that talk about Father Time are mentioned in this program today, so I'm going to skip over those. But all the other symbols, like the scythe and the hourglass and things that are all around him, denote that he is the one representing death. Father Time, in some other cultures and times and places, is also said to represent Cronus, the Greek Titan. So, again, it's got that primordial kind of vibe to it. And that's about it, because all the other symbols we'll touch on this one as well as we get on. Oh, me again. Hi.
We didn't do it on purpose.
This is all part of the same imagery, right, Joe? So like what we're doing here for anybody who's watching really is we're taking this one set of emblems that usually is Father Time, the hourglass, and the Weeping Virgin, you know, and we're just breaking those apart for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And in most jurisdictions in the Master Mason's degree, they are individually broken out. But this was basically a compilation by someone named Jeremy Cross in the 18th century. And just to give you some backstory on this, unless somebody else is touching it on it, then tell me to shut up. But Jeremy Cross was an engraver and an artist, and there was someone named Amos Doolittle who wrote something called the True Masonic Chart, or the Hieroglyphic Monitor, and it was published in the early 1800s. And Jeremy Cross actually took a lot of these symbols and incorporated them into something that we see and we actually represent in our Master Mason's degrees. But the Weeping Virgin is it's a symbol of a young woman who is holding an urn. And that urn is said to contain the ashes of the fallen one, you know, which we'll get into with the broken column. But she's also holding a sprig of acacia, which I know Jason is going to talk about. And in front of her, she's got what some people say is the Book of Life. So the book that inscribes those who have passed on, you know, into that immortal forever in front of her. But she said, as Father Time is counting the ringlets of her hair, so time is passing, and she knows that ultimately, you know, that which she loves is going to end up in that urn, that dust that Robert was talking about. It's hit or miss on who the Weeping Virgin is said to represent. Jeremy Cross and the True Masonic Chart don't actually say anything about it other than that she's a Weeping Virgin. But some people have claimed, if you go to like FreemasonInformation.com and things like that, say that she's said to represent Rhea, the Greek Titan, who was in most stories the mother to Zeus, mother to Persephone, mother to Hera, mother to Poseidon and Hades. So she was a Titaness who came before the Olympians. And she has that, not the Mother Earth type of scenario that her mom, Gaia, has, but she is said to represent the passage of time and the seasons and things like that. So I find that kind of interesting, and I'm actually going to research that a bit more. But I think that covers all of that for Miss Weeping Virgin.
Oh, then okay. On to the fourth piece of imagery.
I'm tired of talking. So
you wanted to come back to this one?
I mean, we just hit on it. You know, we basically covered the whole damn sculpture, so we might as well just put a bow on it. But so.
Well, the broken column. Just to say this, that broken column, and as we alluded to it, she's weeping over the broken column, right? Because what it truly represents is the whoever, a person, whatever, that has been cut down, right, is a broken thing. And so that's just emblematical of a person on its like most surface level.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I think, and going back to the Jeremy Cross story, so the most common interpretation is, and I actually thought this was kind of neat, but the Jeremy Cross story, as he was designing this was something that he later brought into this emblem of the Weeping Virgin and Father Time. And again, according to FreemasonInformation.com and Peter Stones, they both had the same story. He got this idea, Jeremy Cross did, who was a brother. He got this idea from I'm trying to find it right here, from the Trinity Churchyard. There was someone named Commodore Lawrence who fell in a naval battle, and they had a beautiful marble pillar as his tombstone, you know, or his tomb marker. And at some point in time, the top of the marble pillar broke off, and that part of the Capitol laid right next to the base. And it basically remained there for over 35 years. And every time Jeremy Cross passed it, he thought it was really a striking symbol of, you know, that beautiful broken thing that's sitting there, you know, laid in waste as a stark reminder that all beautiful things must end. You can talk about this Kabbalistically as well. You know, if we're talking about the pillar of beauty or the middle pillar, you can, you know, we can have hours long show on the Kabbalistic interpretation of the broken column and where it fits in, you know, into the Sephiroth and things like that. But yeah, that's what was Jeremy Cross's idea when he put this together. Again, early 1800s. But this was, again, symbols that started to show up in that book by Amos Doolittle called The Hieroglyphic Monitor.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Joe.
You're welcome.
All right. I guess it's time for me to start talking now. So the next symbol we have on our list of emblems is the hourglass. And an hourglass, you know, is a device that has historically been used to historically been used to measure the passage of time. You have two glass bulbs typically connected vertically by a narrow neck that then allows a regulated flow of a substance, historically sand. The two bulbs are generally symmetrical so that you can use it both ways. And the origin of the hourglass, we're not sure where it came from, but its predecessor was the water clock, which was a similar type of system that water the passage of time vice sand or particulate matter. And so we saw existence of water clocks in Babylon and Egypt as early as 1500 years before the Common Era. And so, you know, the hourglass is another one of those representations, just like Memento Mori, where it is designed to symbolize that life is fleeting and that the time you have on this earth is not infinite. And so that it is included in the Masonic emblems of mortality as a reminder to do the best that we can with the life that we have today. The hourglass has uses alchemically. It was used in alchemy as a symbol for hour. It's often depicted with the addition of metaphorical wings, and it pays kind of an homage to the sands of time that run out for every human life.
I was waiting for Robert to throw in a foundation reference here, but he didn't.
Man, dude, so much. But you know what is interesting here, as you kind of touched on, Jason, is you mentioned immortality, and you can't help but notice in the particular image you chose for this, the snake almost forms the symbol for infinity, which uh-huh. which is kind of cool. But when we think about ideas like time, also the placement in this image is also perhaps by design. The idea of time is a complete conception, it's an invention by man, right? Like as Werner Heisenberg says, that nature is not what you see, but nature measured by the tools we make, essentially. And so what have we done here? We have invented a concept, a construct that we now live in, that we're completely defined by. This thing that is truly immeasurable. We just kind of think it's there and measure ourselves. But before the hourglass, what did we have? We had the moon and sundials and all kinds of other things. But it is interesting
water
to
clocks.
Note that this
water clocks,
yeah.
Water clocks, yeah. They preceded sure. hourglasses and sundials.
But it's still, you know, it's all an invention by man, and it means something because we agree it does, just like the U.S. dollar. I didn't just say that.
Does it though? I mean, it's. I'm gonna leave the Federal Reserve comment alone there, and what our dollar is based on. But is it though? I mean, because if you go, you know, if we look at this from a astrophysics standpoint, right? We perceive time as a dimension that moves in one point, right? It always moves forward. It doesn't move backward. It can move faster or slower, right? You got things like time dilation. And sorry, YouTube, I'm getting super nerdy now. But we sense our passage through that dimension with time moving forward, right? And so while I agree with what you're saying, I think we're only limited in how we can measure it, right? It's not like we can measure length in both directions or width or height in both directions. Time can only be measured in one direction, technically. So I think it's just our limited understanding of the ability to perceive that
totally.
Dimension. But it's there. The dimension of time is there. We live in it. We die in it, you know? But again, to that point, it doesn't have a forward or a backward. The arrow of time always moves in one direction.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. They actually, there's been some study that they just went through the other day. I was reading this article, like on either The Futurist or something. They were talking about how we have essentially been able to send like information back in time. They said that the key to this now is the idea that we're not actually sending it anywhere. We remove the idea of time from the equation as like a, and we treat everything as a static piece, which is pretty wild. And what's crazy about that is the idea that, you know, the human as we are, in the far distant future, will be to come up with solutions to things that we don't have any solution to today, just based on the idea of psychological evolution. So, you know, what to your point about understanding things, something that we have no clue today in 1,000 years, if we're still around, might just be considered elementary.
Ooh.
Yep.
Oh, that was deep. I love it. Moving on to arguably, I think my favorite symbol in masonry, and probably a lot of other brethren as well, the sprig of acacia. The sprig of acacia, or acacia, is actually a larger species of shrubs and trees, and there are a number of different species of, you know, technically acacia throughout the world. Initially, it comprised a group of plant species native to Africa and Australasia, but now has been limited just to contain only the Australasian species. And so acacia shows up a lot in the Old Testament, as well as in the Masonic ritual. In the Old Testament, it is thought that the rods holding the Ark of the Covenant were made out of acacia. I believe the tabernacle was made out of acacia wood supports as well. It has been postulated that the burning bush that appeared to Moses was actually an acacia bush, and it factors very prominently in the Masonic ritual for the fact that it is an evergreen and gives us the promise of hope and life after death. So whereas I think a lot of these other emblems that we've talked about tonight give us a hard look at the harsh reality of death, this emblem in particular gives us the hope of death not being the end for us. And death, Robert, I think you've said this on the show before, you know, death being a transition as opposed to a decline and an end.
100%. And one of the things that I maybe you just said this, or maybe you've said this in the past, I'll take what you've said, and you've used a line from ritual, and it comes back to this idea of a beautiful transformation, or the symbol alone being this magnificent, you know, almost revelation type thing, because we've talked about the ideas of like the evergreen in a home, right? The thing that survives the winter, the things that survives the fall of the sun. And yet, now here is the evergreen, that wonderful symbol. They say that somewhere in one of the degrees, I don't want to, you know, say where or what it means, right? But that it betrays something else. And you know, you look just but a little farther, and the veil is rent in two. And here is this idea of the next thing. It's awesome. And then anybody who doesn't know, fun fact, Jason was a member, right? He's the past master of Acacia Lodge, and his pin and ties were all Acacia.
Who doesn't know that watches it?
I don't know. He's nobody. The show? Nobody.
My wife knows that.
Well, whatever.
Well, you know, fun fact about acacia species of trees. We've seen this with Brother P.D. Newman. Is that Brother Newman has postulated a well-researched theory that Desaguliers and his contemporaries included acacia in the Masonic ritual because acacia root has entheogenic or hallucinogenic properties. And so acacia root is a naturally occurring source of which has been known, especially in religious ritual circles, to lead whoever takes it on a very transcendental, like, spiritual experience. So that's another side to the sprig of acacia that hasn't been talked about a lot, but is getting more attention with Brother Newman's work. So, yep, love this symbol and what it represents. A couple of years ago, I had the honor to be the guest editor for the Fraternal Review out of the Southern California Research Lodge, and I chose to do my issue on death. And so, you know, death has always been something I've been very uncomfortable with, so I force myself to face it as often as I can. And I think the thing I was most proud of in this issue was I kept the theme, you know, different pieces of death all throughout. And then on the last cover, or on the last page on the outer cover, I just had a picture of the acacia and just left it at that, so that the last thing the reader would be left with was, you know, not a downer of a magazine issue, but, you know, you've just been smacked in the face for 14 pages with the impermanence of your life. And then on the final page, you see the hope that we all have, that there's much more to existence than just the life we have and the time we have here.
And you just really succinctly covered the whole essence of, for me, and probably for a lot of people, Masonic initiation, right? That hope springs eternal, that death is not the end. I really am curious as to how many of our brethren and just people in general truly, really believe that at the end of the day. You know, that death is not the final door, that there's something on the other side. You know, that's where that fear of death really starts to melt away. And the acacia, or the evergreen, exactly as you described it, Jason, is that exact symbol, that things come back. There is a rebirth. There is a resurrection. Maybe not in the same way you were before, but something new comes from the old. You know, it's not the end of the story. I mean, how freaking awesome is that? I just think that we don't impart that lesson as well as we should. And it's kind of a bummer, because it's a very liberating thing to not fear death anymore. But I think the acacia smacking us in the face is a constant reminder of that.
Yeah, I agree. All right, back to the more depressing emblems.
Well, the coffin is kind of a depressing emblem, you know?
There's no happy there.
The images that you're seeing here on screen, you know, one is actually a Masonic slide. This is contains a number of emblems that might be considered a tracing board of a sorts, right? You have all kinds of things within this image. You've got the sprig, you've got the broken column, the veil, the internment, the crypt, all of the things, the spade, which I'll cover in a few minutes. But the coffin is something again, another version of remembering the mortality. It's synonymous, although not quite the same as the skull. It is a stark imagery that is our last resting place. So think about this as you think, you know, this is the thing that you're going to be laid to rest in if you're like most people. If you're like me, you go natural burial. But, you know, this is the thing where you get set in. And it is essentially what you might even consider your regeneration point. And this is the thing that you decay in this container, your essence. And then the container over time starts to break down. And your essence then leaks back into the earth. Your chemical breakdown and the eventual use of your own minerals to form new life. You know, if we change the narrative with our young from the biological response of a fear from death, right? Because then you can reproduce and populate. But if you change the narrative from the end to the immense glory of becoming one with all things, right? Like, what a friggin' honor it is to have been a human and lived and died. Like, it is absolutely this, as Ohan says in the Temple of Doom, the last great adventure. I go first, Indy. It is the thing that really should fill us with a contentment at that moment that we're about to cross this threshold into what we would consider as the unknown. But we do know some stuff thanks to our observable science, and our science tells us a lot of cool things about immortality too. But the Western tradition really uses the coffin. You know, we see in Eastern traditions the burning of bodies, natural burials and things, the confinement of bodies into strapped up packages and left for the animals to pick on because it's a return to nature. You know, the body is useless afterwards. But in the Western world, we're a little bit more hung up with the material sense of existence. So because of that, you know, this material sense of existence has pushed us into the use of things like coffins. There's really several uses for coffins, I think, throughout history. But really, it's number one, it's to protect the body from predators, which is probably not that necessary anymore. We use it to display a body. To frame a body at the time of viewing for closure, and it preserves the body, not indefinitely. I mean, even the best of coffins break down over time unless it's hermetically sealed, triple welded, and all of this stuff, right? But we also see them to honor the dead. So basically, we'll see this more for tombs or headstones and things as a memorial to the individual. And then, you know, a little bit more Halloween sounding here, but it does primarily serve a purpose of stopping the smell of decay from, you know, affecting you as you walk through town or, you know, walk through a cemetery or whatever. And, you know, it does have another purpose to deter grave robbers. It's a lot harder to break into something like that to grab a body or whatever. And again, going back to one of the other reasons I stated was a sense of closure. So the coffin serves a number of purposes here in the modern world and in the ancient world, but as a symbol, really think about it as something that is intimate and kind of awesome.
Absolutely. And you actually touched on something, Robert, that I don't think people get from a Western mindset. Like the whole coffin and burial thing, that's a very European, later European / Western world kind of thing. You know, if you go back to Roman times and Greek times and times before that, especially, you know, in places like the Holy Land and things like that, what do you see? You see crypts and you see little nooks with, you know, entire families in little nooks in crypts, but they're not in coffins and things like that. They're just laid out there. But, you know, if you've ever been to Rome or Greece or anything like that, there are tons of these crypts, that a lot of them that predate and post-date Christianity that are all coffinless places where you put your dead. You know, I can't imagine what they smelled like a couple of thousand years ago, but yeah, you know, the whole coffin thing is, you know, is an innovation, you know, that word that we love to use. So.
Well, there's none of that in masonry.
What's that? I have a question for whoever picked this picture. What is that other brown box sitting there next to the coffin? Is it in case this dude's a vampire and we have to bury him again? Like, what's that other box there?
Hey, so that's just a tomb that they had, a coffin, a traditional tomb slash early 20th century in Louisiana. I picked kind of a morbid looking one for Halloween.
Okay, right on.
Above ground burials in crypts, like you said, right? You can't, it's hard to bury people in places where the ground swells with water and then people come back.
Yeah, it's not bueno.
Ooh, zombie time.
That brings us to our next emblem, the spade.
Yeah, the spade is probably one of my favorite symbols. I can't even say Masonic because it really is not necessarily Masonic in nature. It is a symbol that we have appropriated, like everything else, to bring together and give an awesome lesson. The spade... let's start off with some lyrics here. I see it in your eyes. Take one look and die. The only thing you see, you know it's going to be the Ace of Spades. I don't know if anybody out there. Wow. Like, no, so it can be a symbol that's used in various different ways. However, we see it used in PSYOPs, in the Vietnam War, through various... superstitions and things regarded around it. It's the death card, right? The Ace of Spades. If you want to just think about the Ace of Spades first, because this is the death card. It's a black spade, which is a symbol of digging. It represents digging the grave, the disturbance of earth to return to it, what was taken from it. And just some symbolism on the spade. I mean, the fact that it has always represented death. I mean, if you look at your deck of 52 at home, fun fact, pull out any court card, king, queen, jack, none of them look at the spade. It is designed this way. There are rules and laws around playing cards and the symbolism that they contain. It is, of course, a tarot deck of sorts. And they will never look at the spade because man doesn't want to acknowledge the existence of a possibility of death. So in any deck of cards you buy, whether you buy theme decks or not, 99.99% of the time, the court cards don't look at the spade. They always look at the diamonds. They always look at the hearts because you always want love and you always want money and things. Yeah. So it's all there. It's all all these symbolisms, right? But it's meant to evoke something on the inside, something intrinsic. It should reach down into you without you even knowing. That's why I talked about psyops, right? The ability to see a symbol, for it to reach inside of you, grab a hold of something and yank at whatever string that is. And you go, oh, that is crazy. For whatever reason, this makes me think of this and reminds me to do this. I mean, this is the beauty of symbolism in this entire episode, really. Something else to remember about this, it's often related to, people try to relate it to the trowel. It's not the trowel, guys. It is different. It's the spade, right? So don't automatically make that assumption. It is an emblem of solemnity. It is an emblem of performance. It's an act of care, of delicacy, intimacy. Fun fact out there, if you guys go to Bicycle's website, you'll find an entire deck of 52 cards composed of nothing but aces of spades. It's pretty interesting. But also in modern culture, the Ace of Spades has taken on some symbolism for some of our communities, like anybody who is aromantic or asexual. The Ace of Spades is used in those communities as well, because my only assumption on it is that it's a symbol that is universal in nature, and maybe that is represented there, but it is a fascinating symbol. The spade in itself, in the Masonic term, you know, just comes back to that shovel, which you saw in that coffin image as well, right? It's laid up against the coffin. It is the what do we say, that the spade that digs their grave will necessarily dig our own. It is, you know, it's a rad symbol. All, you know, the symbology in masonry is really crazy to me, because when we, the more we see it, the more we realize, the more we try to break it down, the more we pull out of it. And then at the end of the night, of a night of philosophy or discussing any of these things, we walk away going, holy cow, how did I go 8 years in masonry without knowing that? Or, you know, I mean, it's just crazy to sit here and pick apart these symbols the way we do, because you just don't do it in a lodge. Which is weird, because aren't we supposed to do that stuff?
Absolutely. And I haven't had a fun fact yet, so I have a fun fact, too. So, fun fact number one, the bicycle playing card company started printing the All Ace of Spades decks during the Vietnam War, and they would send it overseas because the U.S. soldiers would leave, like Robert said, would leave the Ace of Spades as the death card, but they used it as psychological warfare and just litter battlegrounds with the Ace of Spades card in that psychological warfare kind of thing. And then fun fact two, only because Robert mentioned it, a shovel and a spade are two completely different tools. A shovel has a broad head, and the spade has the pointy head. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, and I think that that just about wraps us up. We've got, I think, one more symbol, and that is the setting mall. So the setting mall, which we didn't include in the PowerPoint tonight, sorry about that in advance, is a wooden hammer that was actually used in operative times to set the finished stones in the mortar. So you would put down the giant block, and then you had to make sure that it was oriented the right way and that it was level with the other stones and level in and of itself. So you would take this giant bulbous hammer and just, or mallet, and, you know, tap it wherever to create a level surface that would align well with the other stones around it. The setting mall, you know, if you are a Mason, you know, it is very clear as to why the setting mall has a connotation of mortality. But if you are not a Mason, we encourage you to join at some point, and so you can find out the greater lessons there on mortality. So we'll go ahead and we'll start wrapping things up with the final question. So a final question is, what emblem of mortality has had the most profound on you personally, and why? And we'll start with Robert.
That's a really great question. And I love how every week I probably start my question of the week this way. That's a really great question, John, Jason, whoever. It is a really interesting question, because I don't always think about, when I think about symbols of mortality within the craft, if I had to say something within this particular presentation was the most profound, I like the scythe. I think the scythe is a great example, and only because it alludes to, quote unquote, Mother Earth. And there's this line in scripture that says something about, well, it's not just in scripture, it's in the fraternity scripture, I should say. One of our lectures says, but a few more sons, my brother, and we too, you know, will be on death's door, essentially. At the height of our busyness, the frost nips at the shoot, right? This idea that the frost is going to come when we least expect it and take us out. And it talks about how we watch, and this always gives me like the heebie-jeebies, as we watch our friends on the brink of death or our own existence fade with quote-unquote exquisite anxiety. So this line from the ritual is what has always like stilled me. And it just like ravages my mind in a way that shakes me. Like I think about, I mean, if you've ever suffered from anxiety attacks or anything like that, this line, exquisite anxiety, staring off into the abyss. What's next? You know, it's not necessarily fear or happiness. It's some equilibrium of the two, some insane amount of both of these things that release a stream of consciousness unlike anything you've ever experienced before. And it's like that roller coaster. You got on, you're going up, you can't tell them to stop the ride and get off. Right? You got to follow through. So the scythe hits that for me because of the idea of, I go back to this, you know, the frost nipping the chute, or the, you know, Father Time just coming down the field, and the grass is falling and you can stand still. You can't run, but you watch the grass fall as it gets closer and closer and closer. And as we get older, we start seeing, you know, older family members pass away. Then you start seeing celebrities that you grew up with pass away, and then friends. And then you go, who's next? It can't be me. And it is. Like, it's us. So, yeah, it's a solemn thought, not depressing, right? This should give you the fuel to do all the things. Make the difference now. That's all.
Wow. I'm glad that I don't have to directly follow that one. Really, really somber thoughts there, Robert, but awesome as always. So, Joe, same question.
How to continue after that? Yeah, I'm gonna make a motion that I never go after RJ ever again, because that was phenomenal. So the answer to me is, and I'm gonna take a cop out answer, but the answer for me really is that entire Jeremy Cross sculpture. But I'm gonna focus on two parts, and it's basically Father Time is that emblem of death. But for me, I think that entire sculpture, and if you're a Mason, you've seen it before. If we start with Father Time on one side, he's that emblem of death and time, the passage of time. And then as we get to the Weeping Virgin, who's holding the urn, who's in front of the Book of Life, and who's holding that sprig of acacia in her hand, I think for me, it really displays that, hey, there is a finality on this mortal world when you talk about death, but there's always that hope of that bright tomorrow, for whatever way you interpret that, or however you personify that in your mind. There is that hopeful tomorrow. Tomorrow will absolutely come. And that really stark reminder of it, when you see the Weeping Virgin and Father Time counting the ringlets of her hair. Yeah, it's sad. Yeah, it's solemn, but there's got to be the beauty in that immortality that comes after that. And I think that's what that entire sculpture truly displays. Not that we should be sad and crying because something or someone has died, but that it's just another door that bursts you forth into that chapter of immortality, you know, into that next life. I truly believe that. I believe that with all my heart. And I think that it is an excellent symbol to impart lessons to Masons to teach them that once you can give up that fear of death, as Robert so beautifully said, there's nothing to stop you from achieving basically all the all in this life. Robert's comments have drained me of anything intelligent. So with that, love y'all and see you next week.
I don't know, Joe, that was pretty good.
Absolutely. So, and for just a quick second, if you could make that hand motion again a little higher, because it almost looked like you were flipping everybody off.
No, listen. For all the people who know me, when I joined this show, I got the talking to about not to use my regular language or, you know, my usual hand gestures. So I'm doing a very Italian kind of thing. And, you know, I talk with my hands a lot, but yes, I'm keeping it PG-13 because I love all of you.
So the language thing was broken by the Grand Master of Puerto Rico and the most excellent high priest of Royal Arch Masons in Virginia.
So we like him.
All right, over to me now. This shouldn't be a surprise, but my favorite emblem, in as far as the emblems of mortality are concerned, is I will mute you.
Sprig of Acacia is
a sprig of acacia, and for me, it's very deep and vulnerable and personal. It deals with my fear ultimately of the unknown. And so as a researcher, as an intellectual, I can be obsessed with the limits of human knowledge and what we can truly, truly know. And I think there's a limit to how much we can know about what happens, you know, after we pass on, and what the process is like. You know, people have near-death experiences, and there's documentation on those, but they do differ wildly. So the sprig of acacia gives me that hope that the one thing that I do know and can know at the root of my soul is that this life isn't the end of everything. And there is something that happens afterward, and there's the next phase. And so the sprig of acacia helps me become a little bit more comfortable with the unknown associated with the next phase of our existence. And so that to me is why I lean so heavily on symbolism from the sprig of acacia, because it's really speaks to the core of my being and who I am, you know, my personality as, you know, my intellectualism, and then, you know, ultimately, you know, some of my biggest fears. So with that, I hope you all have had a fantastic time tonight. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Hey, there is no episode of The Found Symbol tonight. We will be airing that tomorrow once we have John back with us. So stay tuned tomorrow for episode 7 of The Found Symbol. Thank you all so much for watching, and keep searching for good night. Keep searching for more light. Good night.
Wow.